I went shopping for this song. It's called Expose the Lies. The band is called Motive. I'm Peter B. Collins with News and Comment here on Wednesday, June 4, 2014. And there is a new whistleblower support organization launched by Daniel Ellsberg and friends in Washington, D.C. yesterday. It is a project of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which was started by my friend Norman Solomon many years ago, to bring progressive voices and opinions and ideas into the corporate media. And they have a very impressive list of supporters, including many of the NSA whistleblowers like Tom Drake and Bill Binney, Jesslyn Radack, a whistleblower from the Justice Department, our friend Ray McGovern, many others. I don't want to slight anybody by excluding you. But the point is that this is a group that is operating in the United States, and they're patterned after WikiLeaks, I would say, but with a couple of different twists. Here's their mission statement. Expose Facts aims to shed light on concealed activities that are relevant to human rights, corporate malfeasance, the environment, civil liberties, and war. At a time when key provisions of the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments are under assault, we are standing up for a free press, privacy, transparency, and due process as we seek to reveal official information, whether governmental or corporate, that the public has a right to know. And they are using the Tor software, T-O-R, as a way to encrypt their communications. And they have set up a drop site at exposefacts.org. And so if there are any whistleblowers within the sound of my voice, or if you can deliver my voice to whistleblowers who you know, well, I think this is a very interesting and worthwhile effort. Because I know that, 90 million documents are now annually classified by the government? And we know that not all that information is secret. In a moment, I'm going to get to a court case where the government is trying to declare secret things that have already been published. And so the idiocy around secrecy is one of the other key points that Ed Snowden made in his NBC interview with Brian Williams, but they didn't broadcast that part. No. Snowden made the point, like Tom Drake and others have before him, that the NSA had the information to break up the operations of the terrorists on September 11th, 2001. That is, of course, if you embrace the official story. And in any event, the government, according to Ed Snowden, was unable to connect the presumed dots because it is choking on all of the data that it has collected, mountains and mountains of haystacks, and they're looking for needles to overwork that metaphor again. And what they need to do is be smart. And it would actually make the NSA and its counterparts more effective if they didn't suck up all the information on innocent people, including Americans whose Fourth Amendment rights should protect them from that. So now we go to two federal courtrooms in different parts of the country. First in Idaho, where a judge who has a name that's a wobbler, so I'll identify him as a male, Judge B. Lynn Windmill, there's no D in there, Windmill, is inviting the Supreme Court to overturn a decision that he announced on Tuesday, where he reluctantly upheld the NSA's controversial metadata collection program. He suggested that the program, which collects the data on millions of U.S. phone calls, likely violates the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. But he said that the Supreme Court precedents have tied his hands, and that's why he is begging the Supremes to overturn his decision. And he pointed to the recent controversial decision last year, the one that I fully support, from Judge Richard Leon in Washington, D.C., He said the program was likely unconstitutional and argued that the surveillance is far greater than the case that is the current precedent, Smith v. Maryland. And that, of course, goes back before there was an internet and all of the digital advances in our world today. So this is just another judge crying out for help, saying, I don't agree with the interpretation that I have just affixed my signature to. And I am a creature of the courts, limited in my ability to offer or render the independent judgment that we expect judges to actually offer us. So now we move to a courtroom in Oakland, California, where a judge whose name is Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers is hearing a case brought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And EFF is seeking to get copies of FISA court rulings and other documents also related to the metadata collection program. And a government lawyer argued that information about which phone companies have been ordered by the FISA court to surrender on a regular basis all of their metadata on their customers, the government lawyer is arguing that that should be kept secret. But it was one of Barack Obama's pals who was on that committee that reviewed the NSA and presented 40-some findings, all of which were ignored by the president, most notably that he shouldn't put a military guy in charge of the NSA, and he just put Admiral Mike Rogers in there to succeed General Keith Alexander. At any rate, the president's own group, including a man named Jeffrey Stone, who is a law professor at the University of Chicago, well, Stone published an item back in March. And he named the three companies. Now, this is a cat and mouse game. Ed Snowden revealed these documents a year ago. We saw the FISA court ruling against Verizon. It doesn't take any kind of brilliance to infer that the other phone companies get the same court order on a regular basis from the FISA court. So who are we fooling? And who are we kidding? The American public just takes all this lying down, and I feel insulted. I feel our intelligence is insulted. And this is something of a pattern of behavior by the Obama Justice Department from the very get-go in February of 2009. They were presenting arguments that the courts found unbelievable and said, do you really want us to declare secret something that is already out in the open? That Jeppesen Aviation, a division of Boeing at the time, was the company that the government contracted with for the rendition program, the torture taxis, as they're called? And this Obama administration believes that it can put toothpaste back in a tube, genies back in a bottle, and that's what they're up to again. Meanwhile, in Germany, a prosecutor has opened an investigation into the claims that our NSA was tapping the personal cell phone of Chancellor Angela Merkel. And this is okay, but it's disappointing to hear that the prosecutor, Harald Ranga, said that he will not open an investigation into claims of wider NSA surveillance against German citizens. Well, it turns out that a parliamentary panel has been established to assess the extent of spying by the NSA on German citizens and politicians, and perhaps that will be sufficient. But I'm not so sure about that. And I think that the more we can see investigations popping up all over the world on the pervasive surveillance of the United States, particularly on allies and its the innocent citizens of allied nations, I think the better off we'll be. The Taliban released a video today which depicts the handover of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl last Saturday to American forces in the coast province of Afghanistan. And there's some interesting stuff here. I'm sure the video is going to be all over the corporate TV newscast tonight. And it will be used to stoke this little political firestorm that is growing in a bipartisan manner over the trading of 5 Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo for this one American soldier. John Stewart, if you didn't see it on The Daily Show on Tuesday evening, did a great job of skewering the hypocrites who are trying to make political scores around the release of Bergdahl. So the money quote that you're going to see repeated is that as an American Black Hawk helicopter approaches, one of the Taliban insurgents is heard telling Sergeant Bergdahl, "Don't come back to Afghanistan. If you do, you won't make it out alive next time." Then the helicopter lands. Bergdahl, clutching a plastic bag, is handed over to Americans who are wearing civilian clothes. The Americans quickly lead him away, patting him down and casually dropping the bag that he had been holding. I don't know what was in it. They board the helicopter and fly off. And this is interesting, and I want you to know the source. This is in a news column from the New York Times. And it is rare that the point of view of the Taliban is reflected honestly in the American media. Quote, "But beyond the direct images, the framing of the video by the Taliban, and the commentary heard over it, all go to reinforce the group's portrayal of the United States as a hated invader, and the Taliban fighters' role as banner carriers for Islam and Afghan pride." Now, one of the other issues that's raised in this video is that the members of the Taliban felt that the Americans in the helicopter were really damn rude because they thought that there'd be a little socializing and soldiers at a truce point, hanging out together, maybe smoking a cigarette. But the speaker on the video expresses dismay with the Americans, who rushed through the encounter and didn't stop to talk or exchange polite greetings, as is customary in Afghanistan, even during hostage releases. He complains that they had managed to shake hands with only 2 of the Americans, and that one of them had hastily shoved his left hand forward, considered a particularly rude gesture in Afghanistan. Well, we'll refer those issues to Miss Manners. But what we're seeing now is widespread whining in Washington, D.C., about the release, and John Boehner is piling on, and so is Dianne Feinstein, and she claims to be a Democrat and a supporter of the president. And they are publicly quibbling over really minor issues. The White House said one of the reasons it had to act quickly, even though they've been negotiating for Bergdahl's release for 2 years, was that his health was declining. And so Dr. Boehner and Dr. Feinstein and Dr. Saxby Chambliss, the knuckle-dragging senator from Georgia, all weigh in on the health of Sergeant Bergdahl. And so far, I haven't seen anything that reports his condition. I believe he's in a military hospital in Germany being examined. But certainly members of Congress and those on the Intelligence Committee certainly might be briefed more than the general public is aware. But here we have Feinstein saying, well, he was undernourished, not necessarily malnourished. Unless something catastrophic happened, I think there was no reason to believe he was in instant danger. And referring to the requirement of Congress that the White House give 30 days notice before a swap like this, she said there certainly was time to pick up the phone and call. Well, Di-Fi, I think it's pretty clear why Obama didn't call. Because you would have thrown a hissy fit and tried everything you could to stop this from happening. That's why the Congress wasn't notified. And that's why Obama has been reduced to using signing statements in his attempt to bypass the restrictions that Congress has placed on him. And I'll refresh a comment I made yesterday, that these critics of Obama for the prisoner swap that released Bergdahl think that it's okay for the president to fly drones and fry people on whom we have very little information, maybe even only NSA metadata from their cell phones, and kill them. And Congress doesn't require notification of anything to do with the targeted kill-at-will program of the Obama administration. And they don't seem that interested in forcing the release of the white paper from the Office of Legal Counsel, which we're told provides the legal justifications for the authority claimed by the president. Now, the president has unfettered pardon power. He didn't explicitly use it on Bergdahl or on the members of the Taliban. But I would argue that this is a parallel to that. And again, Congress not at all worried about the president killing people arbitrarily. But when he makes a move like this, they feel free to unload. Tomorrow, I've scheduled two interviews that we'll release in a single in-depth interview podcast. We're going to talk with Andy Worthington, the British journalist who has covered Guantanamo more expansively and exhaustively than anyone I've found. And we're also going to talk to John Eisenberg. He is the attorney for the prisoner at Guantanamo named Diab, who is the subject of a legal struggle over his right to hunger strike and the government's assertion that it can force feed him and keep him alive so that he will never be released from Guantanamo. It's just bizarre. And the attorney there, John Eisenberg, is a man that I have deep respect for, and we are scheduled to talk with him tomorrow, and we'll release the interview directly when we complete the recordings. I want to thank the people who make this podcast possible by subscribing and supporting my work here financially. People like David Polson, Elizabeth Becky Messer, Christopher Welsh, and Deborah Newell. They are longtime subscribers to this program. Becky signed up a couple of months ago. The others have been with us for quite a while. And I want to thank each of them for their support. And some of them also send me emails, feedback, and other kinds of expression about what they hear on the podcast. I'd like you to join them. This is a community where you are always invited to submit ideas, to criticize the opinions and views that you hear from me, because I like a robust dialogue. And I invite you to support this community. Come to my website, peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, the link says sign up. You go to that page and you get choices, $5, $10, $20 a month for our subscription. The best deal is our $50 annual package. And if you sign up and you're from the continental U.S., I will send you a rock and roll CD called Red Flag by John Dist. The other bonus gift, while it lasts, a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. So we're told that elections matter. Yesterday was the primary election here in California. It produced one of the lowest turnout of registered voters in California history. And some of that's understandable. The governor, Jerry Brown, is running virtually unopposed. He drew two Republican opponents who only each got about 10 or 12% of the vote. Most of the constitutional officers under Jerry Brown are running with very limited opposition. And we're seeing that in many of the local races as well. I had a disappointment. I spent the last 90 days working on a campaign for a progressive candidate for the state assembly, Diana Conte. She was challenging a moderate Democratic incumbent, a one-termer named Mark Levine. And the race got complicated with too many challengers. The vote was split. And unfortunately, the Republican, who represents a very small slice of the electorate here because this is a predominantly Democratic area, he sailed into second place with just over 3 points higher than my candidate, Diana Conte. My other big disappointment is that a 12-year incumbent on my county board of supervisors, Susan Adams, who I've worked for on her campaigns when she was first elected and then a few years back, she was defeated by almost 20 points by Damon Connolly, who is very similar to her politically, but managed to ride a wave of anger in our community over plans for housing. And Marin is a wealthy community. A lot of people here feel entitled. and I compare it to the movie Pleasantville, where people think that Marin shouldn't change. They just want to lock in the way it is because, after all, they've got theirs. And we have a crying need for affordable housing, for seniors, for workforce, for people who've graduated from college and want to live here but don't want to live with their parents. And the Not In My Backyard activists have really been shrill. They tried to recall Susan Adams last year and failed, but that created vulnerabilities. And Damon Connolly, in an opportunistic manner, jumped in there, and my surprise was the margin of that defeat. I knew it was going to be I thought it was going to be close, and frankly, it wasn't. It was a washout for my friend Susan Adams. Susan also ran for Congress in the open seat 2 years ago, and as you may have guessed, I have a very high regard for her. She was a nurse in her previous career, and I think she'll be fine. I'm not sure what she'll be doing next. Also, one of the most watched races in California produced a surprising outcome in the primary held yesterday. Mike Honda is a 7- or 8-term Congress member from San Jose. He is a guy who I really like, and he's been an effective member of Congress. He also was a Japanese-American interned during World War II. He spent most of his career as a school teacher and then moved into Congress later in his life. And Ro Khanna is an upstart with some money, a lot of connections in the tech industry, and he had been planning to run in a different district, but he kind of got upstaged there. So he set his sights thinking that Mike Honda was vulnerable. And in our top two primary, Ro Khanna did play second, but Mike Honda got 50% of the vote, and Ro Khanna only got about 25%. So they will face off again in the fall under our top two primary system, and it'll be very interesting to see if Silicon Valley coalesces around Khanna and ends up pushing out Mike Honda. We'll have to watch that one, and I'll update it as we move along here. In the United States Senate this week, we reported to you yesterday on the unusual hearing where both Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, and Mitch McConnell, the Republicans' leader, testified about campaign finance issues. And this is a hearing that is intended to advance the proposed constitutional amendment to fix the bad decision by the Supreme Court in Citizens United. And if you count the votes, even if Harry Reid manages to get this constitutional amendment passed by the Senate this year, it probably won't even be taken up by the House. And if it were, the Republican majority there would smack it down in short order. So what we have here is there was some political theater, and the Democrats, recognizing that dark money and campaign finance issues matter a lot to their base voters, were out there banging that drum to draw attention to their posture, but don't expect product, not anytime soon. Now, speaking of elections, I want to contrast two recent elections. In Egypt, the man who promoted himself to Field Marshal, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, we're told was reelected with 96% of the voters supporting him, even though turnout was thought to be around 30% and was hyped up to 45-46% by the effort to keep the polls open for an extra day. Well, we know that this was a rigged election. This is the Mubarak system back in full force. And the United States issued some statements today. It is looking forward to working with the government of Sisi while urging him to carry out human rights reforms. Now that sounds good, doesn't it? Nice and balanced. Congratulations. Now stop persecuting your citizens. But there was no mention in the nuanced American statement about the recent crackdown on Muslims in Egypt, the trials, multiple cases, where hundreds of people were herded in like cattle. They didn't even allow enough time to name each of the defendants. And with limited testimony and evidence, these people were convicted in mass trials and then mass sentenced to death. There have been more than 1,000 death sentences issued in Egypt in this manner in the last 6 months alone. And the U.S. makes no mention of the imprisonment of the former freely elected president, Mohamed Morsi. The crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which reportedly has killed as many as 1,500 people. So this is an authoritarian military dictatorship in Egypt, and we're announcing how much we support it. All right? Contrast that with Secretary of State John Kerry, who issued a statement that the election underway in Syria is a great big zero that won't change anything. Now, I don't support either Sisi or the brutal dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. But I see no difference between the way they are conducting elections. The only difference is that there is a hot civil war underway in Syria, and in Egypt, the generals have managed to suppress virtually all dissent, and there are no armed opponents in the streets. So, Kerry, who is in Beirut, issued a lengthy statement. The vote is meaningless. It's a great big zero. It won't change anything. You can see the hypocrisy, I'm sure. You can process that for yourself as you will. Steve Horn, our colleague at DSmogBlog, who was the subject of an in-depth interview just last week, posted a story today that on May 30th, just 3 days before the big hyped PR offensive on carbon emissions and climate change by the EPA and the Obama White House, the Department of Interior issued new leases to ExxonMobil, to drill for oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Have we learned nothing from the blowout of the Macondo well in 2011? I fear we have not. And as Horn points out, Sally Jewell, the current Secretary of the Interior, formerly worked as an engineer for Mobil before it was merged into ExxonMobil. The three leases that were issued were won by ExxonMobil in March of this year in an auction where they were the only bidder, and they're paying about $21 million for these three leases. And Secretary Jewell says that you can expect more because we have the U.S.-Mexico Transboundary Hydrocarbon Agreement in effect. President Obama signed it into law last December. And this quote from Secretary Jewell: now we can make additional oil and gas we can make additional oil and gas along the resource-rich boundary between the United States and Mexico available. I see. Make it available. And we have a clear process by which both governments can provide the necessary oversight to ensure that exploration and development activities are conducted safely and responsibly. Yeah, right. Oh, this is sad. It really is. And, you know, as the Obama administration timidly tries to take one step forward on climate change, we take three steps backward on extracting more carbon to burn and heat the planet even further. Ladies and gentlemen, stop the presses, notify the media. Your humble host is about to agree with a statement that was issued by the National Rifle Association. This is a rare moment. I can't think of one that has ever occurred like it. But the NRA is critical of some of these extreme gun nuts in Texas who have been taking their assault rifles and hunting rifles into Starbucks and other businesses as a demonstration to support the open carry gun rights that they claim they have. But the NRA said that these demonstrations have crossed the line from enthusiasm to downright foolishness. Wow! You're saying that about armed gun nuts? Grab the Kevlar, man. They may have you in their sights next. The lobbying arm, the Institute for Legislative Action of the NRA, has called the demonstrations counterproductive to promoting gun rights, called them scary, and downright weird. According to the NRA statement on its website, using guns merely to draw attention to yourself in public not only defies common sense, it shows a lack of consideration and manners. God, we need Miss Manners all over the place today. And that's certainly not the NRA way, says the NRA. And while the group Open Carry Texas declined to talk to the media, they went to Facebook and opened a page saying that if the NRA doesn't retract its comments, Open Carry will have to withdraw its full support of the NRA. I love to see the gun nuts fight each other. I just hope they don't kill each other. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. You're authorized to share this podcast with absolutely anyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.